session number 32299, reel 7.
Tom Lees, reel 7. You were saying about you were thinking of ditching in the Mediterranean?
Oh, ditching in the Mediterranean. As we came down, and I had a number two with me, of course, he was doing most of the communications with the thing. And as I came over, I happened to glance down through a break in the cloud, and there was Nice Airport, and which showed we were on track. And I'd already had experience, because that previous forced landing I told you about, I'm not quite sure that was before or after, but I had had it. We always have lots of practice for forced landings. It's part and parcel of the drill. And I could see that I was in a very reasonable position. And so I just turned round. Of course, the trouble was it was a civilian airfield. I wasn't quite sure that it was Nice, but I could see it was an airfield. And I saw the runway, and that's what I made. And I landed, and as I landed, there was a BEA, British European Airways Viking, about to take off from Nice Airport. And I landed on the other side, I landed slightly downwind, because it was the only, I didn't have any option. And I managed to turn off the runway, and stop. Well, just because the engine wasn't going, and so I stopped, and they had to bring out a tractor. The chap flying the BEA fellow was a bit annoyed about this. He wondered what the devil was going on. He didn't realise that it was a forced landing, but it's just as well. And he had to delay his takeoff for about 10 minutes while he made sure there were no bits and pieces on the runway and that sort of thing. And I stayed there with my number two came down and landed with me, and we stayed there. We went up to the British consul. And he said, oh yes, well, you better stay in the hotel here, because we said, we haven't got any civil clothes, you know, we're a bit tricky. But we had the ammunition bays full of our civilian clothing and everything. And he put us up in a small little place behind the Negresco Hotel, which I think was a quite a good hotel. And it also happened to be the Battle of the Flowers Week, which is a great thing in Nice. It's an annual event, and all the pretty young girls go out and they throw flowers. You're walking down the street, they throw flowers. Actually, this they use. I'm not quite sure what they probably bricks these days. But they flew through flowers. It was a nice little thing. 2 to 3 days we had at the expense of the consul picked up the bill, really. Well, the Navy undoubtedly eventually got it, and we were flown back by passenger aircraft onto Malta.
So the engines within the Sea Fury could sometimes be.
Well, there were a lot of problems with the engine. It was a Centaurus engine, and it was being used in a fighter aircraft. And it's a beautiful engine, and as I say, I got 990 yards when I had two forced landings, and another episode, which I'll talk about in a moment or two. But it was renowned for it, and quite a few people came to grief by the sudden unforeseen stoppages of the engine in the very early stages. But they fixed them all eventually, and by the time the Korean War came along, the only thing that stopped the engine was if you got a bullet in it. So it was like that. At any rate, that's a bit of a sidetrack there. So I joined this 807 squadron, and we went out to go to war. For the Korean War, we flew out first of all in a civilian aircraft. I was a replacement pilot with about another half a dozen of them, and we flew out by BOAC. I think they called themselves BOAC in those days, in an Argonaut aircraft. It was the first time that they'd been used. It was a development of the Lancaster bomber, I think, something like that. And it was the first time it had been used. There were no night stops on the way out, where you used to all the passengers and crew would go to a hotel and stay overnight and carry on. No, this one they had fresh crews all over the place. So the poor old passengers, they took a long time. We were absolutely knackered. We flew first of all to Hong Kong, And then we waited in Hong Kong until the carrier had come down. They'd been up in Korea, and they came back down to for pick up us and a new aircraft and that sort of thing. And then we joined them. We had an interesting time. Incidentally, we were under the command of there at when we were in Hong Kong. That's right, it was Hong Kong, that's right, not Korea, in Hong Kong, when the chap called Charles Debney, who was a senior chap, was in charge of the small little group of people who were joining as replacement pilots. And we had to keep up, he had to keep in practice, because we wanted to be ready for immediate action when we got there. So we had a couple of aircraft there, and Charles Debney one day was going down in his Sea Fury to take off at Kai Tak Airport, and the only way it's built with mountains all the way around it, and takeoffs are always in one direction and landings in the other, etc. So he was taking off, pointing out to sea, and as he got halfway down the runway, to his horror, the starboard wing, because it's a naval aircraft with a folding wing, the starboard wing started to come up and fold. So he put the brakes on quickly, but not he couldn't stop the aircraft on dry land. And at the end of the runway, drops down into Kai Tak Harbour, and there were flying boats floating around and all sorts of junks and things floating over there. And he toppled into the water with the cockpit, with the water coming up to the level of his feet in the cockpit. So the RAF sent us a nice little Christmas card about that. And they had it shown as this aircraft was saluting as it went over the edge with one wing up. And that's exactly what it did look like as well. And poor old Charles was sitting there with his head showing. All he had to do was climb out and sort of wade ashore. So that was nothing to do with the operations. We joined the ship and we went straight up and straight into operations.
Which carrier was it that you joined then?
A Theseus again. Yep. Oh, just gone. Here we are, in Theseus. The 17th Carrier Air Group, Theseus. And on December the 5th, we were there, we were the first with the Sea Furies. The Sea Furies were painted on the wings with black and white invasion things. I've got the pictures of them there, of the thing. There's the Sea Fury. That book you've probably heard about it.
So it was a recognition site.
That was the idea. Yes. Although the American aircraft didn't have that on it. It was just the British aircraft. And on the 5th of December, I had my first action thing, which was a combat air patrol, just to get me thing. 35 minutes didn't last for long. And on the 6th, the next day, went off on a recce trip, rocketing troops in a village north of Chin Ampo. We were there at a very interesting time, because it was a time when the North Koreans had come down, and the Chinese had sort of beginning to enter the war, and the United Nations forces were being pushed right to the south of Korea. And they ended up in a little sort of circular bit right on the extreme tips, and luckily they weren't pushed off the whole island. But we did a lot of work actually flying to assist the army.
So you were doing more close air support at that stage?
We were doing a lot of close air support at this stage. I'll just read out here. There's a lot of reconnaissance going on. Although the North Koreans were crafty and they used to move at night time because they knew we weren't night qualified, we couldn't fly. But we go on. We were attacking coastal targets. They were using a lot of junks to move people around, and we'd spend a lot of time strafing junks, motor vessels with troops, etc. Recce, Chin Ampo to Pyongyang area, found approximately 10,000 enemy. And that's what we said, that was the very first thing. We didn't attack those, they're all on the road. And in actual fact, what they were was refugees with a large group of North Korean army infiltrators. And I remember it's a great, that's not 10,000, because obviously we didn't count them, because the road was blocked with them, a hell of a lot, for quite a few miles. And we flew on either side of them at about 500 feet. Probably the soldiers were firing at us all the time, but we couldn't see, but there were some soldiers there. And this group of people just shuffling down the main road, going down towards the south. That was done. Combat air patrol, etc., etc. And the weather was very...
You combat air patrols, are they just above the carrier area?
Really? Yeah, that's right, yeah. Because the carrier was operating about 60 miles off the coast of North Korea. They didn't want to be too far away, no, they didn't want to be too close. The Yellow Sea is a very shallow sea as well, and on a good day you could look down and you could see where the engines of the propellers had turned up the mud. Because, you know, I'm not saying that they were only missing the bottom by a couple of feet, you know, but the effect of the propellers would stir up some mud, even though it was maybe 100 or 2 feet below them, because you only got to look up behind, see how the wave formed behind a ship traveling at speed, and we could track the carrier where it had been by following the mud trails. But also the sea froze over there this time. It was very cold, and we used to take off before daylight, as a milk run, going up to this place Chinampo, at whatnot, and we'd take off in the dark conditions, and be launched, and off we'd go. By the time we got back 2.5 hours later, it'd be daylight, so we wouldn't have any trouble in landing on. But that milk run, which we called it, up to Chinampo, was the standard thing.
And that was a standard reconnaissance, was it?
We used to go fly FS, unless we'd been briefed to do some specific military thing, like, for instance, bombardment spotting or something of this sort. This is what we did. They want the army, the intelligence people wanted to know if there was any sign of any movement, so we'd be told which road to go up. We used to go right up to the North Korean border with China. We had to be careful, but we didn't go too far up at Anju and back the way down away.
So was that, with the army being in retreat at that stage, in essence you were providing the eyes for...
Yeah,
behind the lines, because they couldn't.
Oh, that's right. We would be debriefed by our own intelligence officers whenever we got back, tell them what we'd seen and whatnot, and that would be, and they'd compare all the different stories that they were getting, and they would get a great deal of intelligence. But the North Koreans were, there's no, undoubtedly true that they were pretty clever. They moved at night time. Whether or not they used sort of dummies, it's difficult to tell, but it's difficult to actually from the air, especially if they're parking under a tree or something, to tell whether it's a dummy thing or whether it's a real thing. But that's life. At any rate, Pyongyang, recce in a snowstorm south of Pyongyang, found 20 U.S. tanks, United States tanks, ditched rockets. It must have been a bad day there. Of course, that's the sort of thing. So we carry on doing this thing day after day. We'd operate for a certain period, about 10 days or so, and then we'd withdraw back to Sasebo in Japan and have 10 days off while by the engines and all the maintenance work was carried out, and our place would be taken by a United States carrier. And this is the way we carried on all the time.
So a constant rotation of carriers.
A constant rotation carrier, normally speaking, from the same area. And when we got back, we never knew what sort of role we were going to take, whether it was going to be reconnaissance or just combat air patrols or what it was. But as I say, we were there at an extremely interesting time when there was a great movement of the army. And having been pushed right back down to the bottom there in Pusan, and we began to advance again, then we had to be careful because we were briefed. Everything was, there's a bombardment line. You would be told how far up our troops had been. Don't attack anything, south of this line, because you'll be knocking our own people off, etc. So the bombardment line, the bomb line, was moving further and further up towards thing, as are our army chaps. And of course the army included people like the I think the Gloucesters and people that were well known. They were all British Army, and we did give support to the British Army as often as we could. But we also gave support to the other United States as well.
And what form would that support take? What would you be attacked?
Well, it would be told. I'll just see if I can find anything here in reference to it. These were, to begin with, it was mostly reconnaissances because the here we go, close support, rocketed and strafed enemy troops on a wooded hillside. That would be under the control. We'd be called down to do that by the army chaps. They have these forward air observers and say we're being held up by the troops who are going to strafe the hillside. As long as they gave us the permission to do it, we would go in live and strafe the troops, because we couldn't actually see any troops there. You might see some, but then you'd be told what to do it, so you'd riddle the thing with bullets and hope for the best. Another one here, close support, rocketed enemy headquarters in Anyang, strafe troops on a hill, holding up advance. That's the sort of thing that you would expect us to do.
So essentially you would be given a target area and you would attack that?
Not just like that. If we were given a target anywhere in Korea, north of the bombing line, was open territory, we could attack anything, if we were on that sort of a mission. But sometimes we would be handed over to control, to a forward air controller. And he'd be an army chap, and in this case, the army was obviously being held up by the North Koreans, so they would be in touch with this chap. He would be in touch with us and say, strafe these troops, and we go, you see pictures of him, down and fire, and that's what these boys are doing here. And also, we did a lot of bombardment spotting. This was I'd done a lot of practice bombardment spotting, and we did quite a bit of it. Bombardment spotting for the United States St. Paul, that was a cruiser. And I also rocketed the factory, causing a small bang, and strafed positions on a hillside. That was one.
When you're bombardment spotting, what does that actually entail?
It involves you being given the position of a specific target, and the warship would be off the coast, and you identify the target, and then when everything's ready, you have to go through a rigmarole. When everything's ready, you order the warship to fire, and they fire a shell, and you see where it goes, and if you're lucky, it lands in the area of where it should land, in the area of where the target is. You spot where it is, and the idea is, if it's gone too far, you bracket the enemy. So you say down 200 or down 400 or whatever it is, or left 400 or whatever, and you bracket it. Then you finally get the. Get a close thing, and you say fire for effect, and then they just have open thing until you say stop or whatever it is. So you are actually controlling the ship's guns, which are throwing shells maybe from 10 miles away or more, and that's the way it goes. And I did a bit of that, quite a bit of that. There was a St. Paul, and there was another one here, and close support in the Incheon area. Incheon. It's an interesting one. We did some landings there and in Incheon, and it's got a very. I remember it's also got a very high horizon fall of the tide. It's got to be careful. That didn't affect us, Close support in the Incheon area, rocketed and strafed troops on a hill north of the Han River. Close support, rocketed army barracks in Seoul. Of course, but don't forget, Seoul at that time was the now the capital of Korea, was there, was occupied by the enemy. Stress, weather not good.
So was that at the time of the landings that you were doing that support? So, was that at the time of the landings that you were giving that support?
No, actually, I can't remember being operating actually at the landings. The landings did take place. And it was, I think it was the United States thing rather than the British thing. I'm not quite sure about that, actually. But no, we didn't do anything. It may have been done when we were on off duty, as it were. Tenry. So this is the day after day. It was the same thing, and we were always in the same position on the west coast. We went to operate on the east coast on one occasion because the Americans didn't have an aircraft carrier and they were doing some jiggling. I'm not quite sure what it was. We decided we'd operate over there, which is an area we didn't know. And there's an interesting little episode here. On the 10th of April 1951, I was doing a reconnaissance south of Wonsan on the east coast. I was attacked by two corsairs, etc. Now, I've got my original battle, my initial thing here. I don't know whether you want me to read this out. Because this is a thing here that happened. Lieutenant Lees, whilst flying as number two to Lieutenant Lavender on an armed reconnaissance south of Wonsan, we were investigating enemy activity in a valley, map reference CU6002, when I saw two Corsair fighters, which I reported to my number one. While we turned to starboard at 4,000 feet, the two Corsairs dived into the valley and dropped a bomb. In map reference, the same thing. On recovering from their dive, they must have sighted us because they started to climb in our direction. We continued a gentle rate one turn to starboard until the Corsairs were astern and closing. We thought they were coming up to us. We had our aircraft painted like this, and we thought they were going to come up and join up and formate on us. And they were closing when my leader ordered brake. I immediately opened the throttle fully and commenced a steep climbing turn to starboard. But almost immediately, there was a loud bang from the engine. So I throttled back and eased the turn, as I did not realize I was being fired at. By this time, I was wondering what was going on. By this time, the leading Corsair, which still had one bomb under his starboard wing, was dead astern of me, and he opened fire. I saw many tracers flashing over my port wing and turned violently to starboard, breaking down. The Corsair did not attempt to follow, and as the aircraft was on fire and vibrating and the starboard wing tank was on fire, I returned to the ship. That was basically the thing. But what they'd done is they'd got so close behind me that the bullets were, we had more than 30 bullets in the aircraft. The harmonization of the guns is such that if they don't go straight out, they're due to meet at the point about 200 yards ahead, and that's what had happened. If he'd been further back, all those bullets would have been banging me, and it probably gone clean through my body, knocked me to pieces. But because he was so close behind me, the bullets from his starboard side were going into my starboard wing and the port side. So we were having, so that's what it was doing. As he set my starboard wing on fire, and I looked down, it was all glowing red, and I thought, let's get out of it. First of all, get out of it. And I thought I'd better think about it. I looked around, I couldn't see anything, which is, of course, everybody always says that in any battle. You can't, the first thing you do, you lose yourself. And I thought, well, I'd better bail out, because that wing is liable to break off any moment. But suddenly the wing went out, and I thought, Christ, it's my lucky day. And we slowly started, I think, well, you know, the engine didn't, no more bangs from the engine, and we started flying back. So all I had to do was to test the flying controls and just check it in the landing configuration, because I had to, still had to land on the aircraft carrier and whatnot, and everything seemed to, I was quite reasonably happy, and landed on like that. The aircraft was written off. It was too severely damaged to have anything else to ever fly again. And but that was, I was just very lucky. I wasn't personally hurt at all, but my some of the controls were shot away, and but I was just lucky. That was an American Marines. American Marines have got, you know, we made an official complaint, obviously, to the local admiral, and the two Marine guys were, I understand, hauled over the coals. But there was a war on and the rest of it, and I suppose they said they did claim that a couple of Russian type aircraft had been shot down, and of course. That's because the Americans are like that. They think that the only people fighting their war are other people, other Marines, and they do have that. And you've only got to listen to the thing. But I've suffered from friendly fire, so there we are.
Tom, did you attack in any sort of transport targets? I'm thinking of either seagoing vessels or trains or...
Anything that was moving in the area which we had been allocated, we could open fire on. If we saw any junks, if we saw anything moving, trains, lorries, etc., we'd go in and bang them up. Absolutely. That's right. That's what we're doing all these reconnaissances for. But of course, they learned that very quickly, so they didn't move these things. And if they did move, they stood every chance of being being banged, you know, hit, attacked. We had the machine guns in the aircraft, and we had rockets. That was the standard thing. We could carry eight rockets in the, and they were there, and they were jolly good, and very 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 accurate. And occasionally, if we were attacking a special occasion, we might carry switch to bombs. This was, generally speaking, if we were going to attack a target, which the army wanted us to demolish, attack a bridge, for instance, and things like that, we would go in and do what we could for them.
What was the kind of anti-aircraft fire that you would face?
Oh, there was the worst stuff, because a lot of the reconnaissance involved flying down low, below about 2,000 feet and whatnot. You'd be sort of wandering around there. Up high, of course, you'd only get infrequent flak. Sometimes you'd be flying along and suddenly you'd get the puffs of smoke coming up. So but you would be weaving around all the way. But nearly every aircraft that was shot down, and we lost a fair proportion of aircraft that way. Was hit by mass small arms fire from low level machine guns or something of this sort.
And was there a threat from North Korean or Chinese aircraft to your aircraft?
And not when we were there. No, but the I think after we'd left. Because it was a Fleet Air Arm chap flying a Fury, a fellow called Hoagy Carmichael, who was credited with having shot down a MiG, which was at that time the Chinese MiGs had started entering the war in support of the. But we didn't have any trouble.
At that time, there was nothing. Was
no,
there?
The only time. I think they might have been doing something. I remember once going over Pyongyang. We'd been up to the Yellow River, way up in the north. And as we were coming back, we flew straight over the Pyongyang airfield. That was a hairy thing. And as soon as we came anywhere near the bloody airfield, all the anti-aircraft fire, and the tracer bullets were going all straight across. We were only up about 50 feet in the air, you know. But none of us were. I think we one or two collected a small little bullet hole here or there or something or other, but we went zoom, we were there and back. But they may have had some aircraft there, but we didn't really see anything at all. I don't know why the hell we flew right over the middle of the day. It was a pretty dangerous place. That was at Pyongyang as well.